within the Torah, there are 613 mitzvot. Okay, so mitzvot is kind of where we get the words commands or laws. But you have to really understand that in Hebrew, the word mitzvot literally means sacred deeds. Okay, we look at it from like a judicial system, like they are commands, they are laws. You are to do these. In Hebrew, is more like if you wanted to walk in step or walk in harmony or kind of be dancing in rhythm, this is how you would live your life. It's just so much poetic and so much better than just like command, do it. And what's amazing is the rabbis for, I don't know, thousands of years would literally basically kind of like a college football poll would rank these mitzvotes from 1 to 613. All right, so this kind of like in most important. So, you know, you'd have like 1, Alabama, 2, Clemson, 18, Wisconsin. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like where it would be. That's actually kind. That's kind. I ain't being kind. So like, here's the thing. So what you have to understand is they would rank them. So the first one, obviously, is what we know as the Shema, all right? It comes from Deuteronomy chapter 6. It says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. And one means, one in Hebrew is the word Ahad, E-C-H-A-D. And this idea is like whole. It's like not fractured, not splintered. And this is what God desires of us, that we would be whole, one. Not fractured, broken, splintered, one. So the call is to Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. To love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. Different translations kind of like have different kind of words that they add into it. But what's so beautiful is there is this word in Hebrew at the end of this phrase that is the word mahode. And it's like, there's no real true transliteration to get that to English. But the best way that you can describe it is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all of your muchness, which I think is just so awesome. It's like to love God with every ounce of your being. Now, what's amazing is the second commandment or mitzvot was where there was great debate. Now, there were two rabbis 50 years before the days of Jesus, two rabbis. One rabbi was a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Hillel, okay? And the other rabbi was named Rabbi Shammai. Now, what's so amazing is these two had schools in which they would teach and train disciples in their interpretation, okay? So these two had different kinds of understanding of how the 613 laws or commands or mitzvot would be ranked, and they would battle each other. I mean, it was just debating. And they would just have different, and you would know if you were part of the school of Hillel or if you were a part of the other school, and they would just battle. Now, when you get to the New Testament, I'm just throwing all this stuff at you. When you get to the New Testament, there's 8 great debates. 7 of the debates, Jesus sides with Hillel. One time, he sides with Shammai. Now, fascinating, okay? So number two, best mitzvot to the Hebrew people, according to Hillel, was to love your neighbor as yourself. So Jesus comes on the scene 50 years after this, Hillel, and he basically says, yep, 1 and 2, that's what I think. I'm with this. Now, this guy said that number one was is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. Number two was to be holy as God is holy, which was all centered around purity laws, okay? Holiness was centered around purity laws, and so if someone was bleeding and I was a priest, I couldn't touch that person. Because if I touched that person, I'd be unclean, and I couldn't do my job in the temple. So when you read the parable of like the Good Samaritan, and you hear a story of a priest and a Levite stepping over someone and walking, you read that and you go, oh, they side with number one being love God, number two, not loving neighbor, because if I love neighbor, I would get down and get messy. No, number two, it's about being holy. Here's the thing. The way that we live our lives, we have a view of what is the most important laws. What is the most important commands? What is the most important ways in which we are going to walk in step and in tune and in harmony with God? And for some of us, it's to love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all of our muchness, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. For others of us, it's something else. It could be something like know God's word and be safe. But when you begin to actually live into the commands that Jesus teaches, you will begin to see yourself as a disciple following him in his dust, in his steps, and he's going to take you to some places you never dared to imagine. And he does that with the disciples. And today I want to teach you a passage of scripture. I'm sure every one of you have read this. If you have any sense of Catholicism in your family, you've probably heard this story taught in a certain way. I want to bring you into Jewish context because I want you to hear, again, just out of Colossians, the sense of rooted and built up. I want you to see this concept of being built. And so I'm going to read this passage, and then I'm going to break it down for you, and then really see where God takes it. So if you have a Bible, turn with me to Matthew chapter 16. If you don't, it's okay. It's okay, I'll read it. All right, Matthew chapter 16, first book of the New Testament. It says this. When Jesus came, verse 13, came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, two words, Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. And the gates of Hades, or the gates of hell, will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Just continue on just for a moment. From this time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said, "this shall never happen to you." And Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Fascinating. Verse 24, then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? But the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done." Verse 28, "Truly I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Now, how many of you are familiar with this passage? Show of hands. Okay. What I want to do is I want to take you just for a few moments into Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi is about 25 miles from Galilee. Now, this city was named Caesarea Philippi based after King Herod's son, Herod the Great's son, Philip. He called it Caesarea, but there was too many Caesareas, so he added Philippi for himself, Philip, because he didn't have an ego. Now, but this city had roots based on Greek gods. And the city was known as Banias, B-A-N-I-A-S. And the city was based on a god called Pan. So kind of it's weird, it's Banias, but the god Pan, it's really kind of Panias, but they don't know how to spell. We do the same thing in English. We have words that don't make sense, like tuna fish. We think it's one word, but it's really two words. But it's like, it's crazy. That's a joke from last night. Now, here's the thing. So what's amazing, though, is Panias was based on this god named Pan. And Pan was half goat, half man. Okay? Just bizarre. And what they believed was, in Caesarea Philippi, this little opening water would go into it. And they actually believed that this was the gates to the underworld. And during the winter months, they believed this is what Panias and the god of Pan and these Greek kind of soldiers and the cities believed, that like these like spirits would enter into this cave and go into the underworld. Now, quick time out. Jewish people have a profound fear of water. This is just a cultural truth. And it's based in Genesis chapter 1. And the idea that like the chaos, that the earth was like, the world was like chaos, and there was like darkness over the deep. And they just did not believe and like water. Even like when you see like the fishermen out and it's like winds and waves, they consider like the seas, the abyss, because there was all of this thinking that the gods and the spirits lived in the underworld and they got there through water. Okay, this was just the thinking back then. So what's amazing is they had all of these kind of temples throughout this little region and valley that celebrated this god called Pan. Now, I'm going to show you another slide. Let's go to our next one, please. Now, this is kind of an artist's rendering of what these temples would be. If you went there today, I've been around there, there's still, like, you can see kind of the structures, the ground, the foundation, some kind of poles are still there. Some even of, like, the grottos into the wall, into the mountain, the face are still there. But what would happen is once every 2 years, 250,000 people would come into the city. And they would gather into the city, and it would be, in my opinion, The closest thing you can think of is like Vegas meets the red light district in the Netherlands. Like it was graphic, okay? And I don't want to go into it, but I would tell you that the idea was it was to excite the gods. And by exciting the gods, they believed that if the gods were excited, it would actually bring security, prosperity, and blessing. And the blessing that it would bring was to your land and to the womb. And so people would come from all over in hopes that somehow Pan would be excited, would leave the gates of the underworld and bring about blessing and provision. And this is what they would do. I mean, you have to understand, they were trying to keep the gods happy. They were so afraid that the god of Pan would be angry and hold back blessing from the womb or hold back prosperity or hold back from them actually being attacked. And so they would do things, cutting themselves, animals, I mean, massive like orgy stuff. I'm just trying to be, this is what you can read about all this stuff. You don't have to because I just told you, but like literally, like this is what they would do. And here's the crazy thing. No Jewish boy would go here. No Jewish boy would go here. And Jesus takes his disciples here. This is fascinating. If the Jewish boy said, hey, grandma, like I'm going to go to Caesarea Philippi, she's like, no, you're not. You're not going there. And so Jesus takes, and I don't believe he took them during this massive 250,000 person celebration, but I do believe that there's a space where he took them where you can overlook and you can see all of this. And now when I imagine all of these guys knew this, even though there was probably one junior high student who was a disciple, 10 of them were high school age, most scholars would believe, and one, Peter, was probably a college student. That's probably what the ages were. And so they're like kind of walking towards and all of a sudden Jesus just asks this question. Hey, who do people say I am? Who do people say I am? And I really think this is a powerful, powerful question. Who do people say I am? And I love what they answer. They answer honestly. Well, some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. Still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets. Basically, what they're saying is you're either someone who's coming before the Messiah, or you're someone who is a great teacher, or you're someone who's a prophet. That's kind of what they're saying, that other people are saying. You're coming to prepare the way before. That's what John the Baptist was. You're a prophet. You're a teacher. And to this day, if you ask most people, they'll say Jesus is a great teacher. He's a great teacher. He's got some great ethical truths. But then what I love about this, and I don't know if you've ever had one of these experiences where maybe someone just points their finger at you and go, but what about you? Who do you say Jesus is? And this is what Jesus does, just kind of stops, and he looks at Peter, the oldest of the disciples, and he probably puts his finger in his chest and goes, what about you? Who do you say I am? And I love it because Peter says this, Simon Peter says this, you are the Messiah. You are the anointed one. You are the one that we've been hoping for. You are the Son of the living God. And I think there's something really, really powerful. Because there's a moment for every one of us and for every one of our kids and our grandkids where they've got to be able to answer this question for themselves. They've got to be able to know, man, I know who Jesus is to me. And I talk about this often, but I think that C.S. Lewis did it so brilliantly when he talked about the great trilemma. That every person has to wrestle with who Jesus truly is. Who he truly is. And C.S. Lewis said, you know, the easiest way for him to describe it was this great trilemma is that Jesus is either a Lord of all, he's either a liar, or he's a lunatic. And you've got to choose one. He's either Lord of everything, and everything he spoke about is true, and how he calls us to live, we ought to live and follow in his steps. We either say, you're Lord of every ounce of me, I'm going to love you with all of my muchness, every part of me, and I'm going to trust you even when it's hard, even when it doesn't make sense. Or, you know what? He's a liar. Like, what he said isn't true. Or he's crazy. Like, if someone, you know, hits you, turn the other cheek. Crazy. So you sit there and you go, he's got to be one of those three. And what's so beautiful is in this moment is Peter says, no, he's Lord. He's the Messiah. I don't know where you were when someone asked you that question or when you felt that sense that, no, I don't believe Jesus is a liar. I don't believe what he said was crazy. Like, I actually think he is who he says he is, and he is worthy to receive my entire life. He's given me gifts. He's given me blessings. I just want to give him everything back. And when you live like that, it changes you. But then it continues on, and Jesus just says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And then this is the verse I want us to spend time on. And I tell you that you are Peter. So you've been known as Simon, or Simon Peter. And on this rock, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome. So I grew up believing that when Jesus said these words, he said, and you are Peter, which like in Greek is like, you are rocky. Like your name means rock now. Like, and you are rocky. And then it's like, I was taught, and on this rock, Peter, I'm going to build my church. Anyone ever heard that teaching? Yeah. But let's now just put it in this kind of context. Jesus being 1,150 feet up above ground on a rock, looking at another rock where there is a gate of Hades and all of culture descends and they've built up all of these temples. I think that Jesus is saying, very well, Peter. And I want to tell you this. You are rocky. And here's what I want. And on this rock, in front of all of this crazy town, all of this culture that has just gone astray and awry, here is where I want to build my church. And the gates of Hades will not be able to overcome. But do you understand what happens when we say, oh, it's on Peter? Right there, we've built it on a person. Not helpful. Two, we can easily remove it from culture, and we can create something away from actual people. And let's just be really, really honest. A mentor of mine would always say this. God has always ever only been about people. People. And so what we can do is create it on a person, move it over here, and the people who need this message, the people who are trying to experience grace, love, and peace, and truth, and honor, and love, all of that, we're missing it. And instead of going to them, we're over here. I'll take it even farther. There's this amazing, amazing professor in Chicago. And he's unbelievable. And he talks about even how our church buildings tell a story. And I grew up kind of like Christian church in Southern California. My parents didn't go to church. I'd ride my bike to church, and I went to church, and some of you know this story, but because two juniors in high school took a liking to me and became my first mentors, their names were Dominic and Nathan. I was a 7th grader. They were an 11th grader, but these two guys, Dominic and Nathan, they went by the name Dominate, which is just awesome, and true story, and Dominic came up to me one day and said, hey, do you want to learn how to dominate life? And to this day, it's like the greatest question anyone's ever asked me. And they started taking me to In-N-Out, which is where like the Shekinah glory descends in burgerly form, but like it's just heaven on earth. But like we'd sit there and we'd have these questions about faith and about God, and I saw something in them. And they had to be of God, because what junior wants to hang out with junior hires? And they drew me in and they taught me. And they just said, within 7 months, I'm getting baptized and I'm riding my bike to church. And I remember walking into this church. And I remember looking up, and it looked like the building was an upside-down ship. And I just remember looking at that going, that is amazing. Not like this building is beautiful, but like this, the building that I was in was an upside-down ship. It wasn't, and it felt so unique, and it wasn't until 20 years later, and I'm listening to this professor from Chicago, North Park University, talk about how the architecture of buildings almost was if we created church buildings in the Christian church where I went, I still love, Restoration Movement, and all of a sudden, like, it was as if we built these upside down arcs because the world was bad and we needed to enter into the ark to protect ourselves from the world. And again, you think about this, the medium's the message. And if you understand this, it's like, culture's bad, I'm over here. Well, if we've got the message of grace, if we've got this sense of faith, if we've got this sense of truth, if we've got this, the scriptures, if we've got the Holy Spirit, and God's just bringing his son Jesus to this earth and basically entrusting his story to his disciples, and he takes his disciples to this place and goes, that's where I want my church, is right there. I want it to influence culture. I want it to shape it. All of these people are doing these bizarre, I want to see a better way. And yet for many, the easiest thing is to retreat. And I think what's so amazing is every city that I've been into, that I've lived in, they've had strongholds. Strongholds. Strongholds of the enemy. And the cities have all been different. I could tell you about Fullerton, California. I could tell you about the strongholds it has. I lived in Barrington and Hoffman Estates, Illinois. I could tell you about the strongholds I would experience, different from Fullerton, different from Camarillo, which was my hometown, 63,000. It's perfect air. It's amazing. You should, like, move there. But, like, we all can't afford it anymore. But, like, it was good. But, like, I could tell you, I could even in Phoenix beginning to unpack the strongholds. And what's amazing is I think God is giving you all stories and gifts, abilities. And when you have the faith, it's like he's taking us up going, all right, let's build goodness here. Let's do something profound here that goes after the strongholds that the enemy has in this city and in this place. But sometimes it's just easier just drive into our house, close our garage, just stay in our house, not get to know our neighbors, not actually take what we have, not actually walk and pray for our schools, not for actually like try to engage with our neighbors, not actually live this. And so when I read this passage in Colossians, is that God wants to root us and build us up. It's for what? It's so that we can actually engage in culture and influence culture. I'll take it to shoes, which I might lose most of the room here, but but it's important. There, the former manager for the Chicago White Sox, his last name was Manuel, and he had a son named Jerry Lorenzo. His Jerry Lorenzo's sister is a woman by the name of Angela Davis. She was a track star. She basically runs like spin cycle, like the classes that are way too intense for me, but like people love it. But Jerry Lorenzo has created a clothing company called Fear of God. Have any of you heard Fear of God? Okay, a couple of you. So he just got a collaboration with Nike. Okay, so he's created this clothing company called Fear of God, and Nike has seen what he's created, and Nike goes, hey, would you like to do a collab for a shoe? Which is pretty, pretty intense. Like, this doesn't really happen unless you're like somebody. And so Jerry's just kind of new in this scene, does this. He creates this shoe called the Nike Air Fear of God, and he only makes a couple thousand of them. And the thing sells out like crazy, like overnight. It's unbelievable. And when you look at the shoe, it's a beautiful shoe, okay? You look inside the shoe, it says 6-10-23-24. I'm like, thinking about the TV show Lost, I'm like, is that the combo? Like, I don't know, what does it mean, you know? And so I've been doing all this research. 3 months ago, I find myself at a Laker game, and which then never happens because I can't stand the Lakers. But anyways, like I found myself at a Laker game with some friends, and I look beside me, and Jerry Lorenzo's there. And I'm like, oh my goodness. So I just walk up to him, and I'm like, hey man. And like, you know, we just kind of embrace for a second, and I just I'm like, 6-10, 23, 24, what's that about? And he goes, 6th book, 10th chapter, verse 23, 24. And I'm like, Joshua? He's like, yeah. And I'm like, well, what's the verse? He goes, look it up. You got a phone? I'm like, thanks a lot, man. That's... I was like, well, if you put it in a shoe, you shouldn't have it memorized. But like, anyway, I start like looking it up, right? And literally, this is what this guy, it says. It names, and some of you, if you're Bible, you're probably looking at it right now, but I'll give you the gist of it. What it says is, he names off these kings that Joshua is supposed to go after. And then what he says is that I want you to step your foot on the necks of these kings. And I want you to be strong and courageous, which, as some of you heard the first night, that's kind of like my mantra, my anthem. It was the Hebrew people's battle cry. It was this phrase, Rock Shazak. It's like I hold on to it. I say it. I scream it at times. I whisper it. It's like it's so important to me. But the sense of if I'm actually going to be a disciple and I'm actually going to take the steps that Jesus is asking of me, it's going to require being strong and courageous, not in me, but in who God is calling and what God is doing and who God is. And so I'm reading this passage on my phone in front of him, and he looks at me and goes, that's what I wake up every morning to do. I said, what? To step on the necks of culture, to advance good, and in a system and a market that is just completely just terrible, I want people to experience the fear of God. And I just backed up right there and was like, oh my goodness. And for some of you who are business leaders, for some of you who are serving in your church, for some of you who are doing incredible things in your neighborhood or in your city, the invitation is for you to be strong and courageous to go and where we see evil, not to run away from it, which is so easy to do, but to trust that the God who is with you and for you, to step on the next, to be strong and courageous, and to take your story, to take what you have, and go there. And this, I kid you not, if you live into this, your faith story will not be like this. And I will say this, when you get around people who have experienced suffering and pain, and they keep taking steps forward, and you sit and listen to them and go, teach me how you have had courage, you will just grow. You will just grow. And there have been people who have had different experiences, different pain and suffering, and I've just sat and listened, and I just, how do you keep doing good? How do you keep, and you know what they come back to? An old spiritual, a verse, a truth, the faith that they saw in their mom or their dad or their grandparents, and the courage that they know God's doing something. And I'll be honest, my tendency is to kind of get close to it and then to run. Because I don't want to fail. I don't want to do it wrong. And oftentimes, it's just kind of how we've translated that verse. I put it like on the Peter within me instead of putting it on the God who is already there and the God that wants to do something. Real quick, just a quick question for you. Do you know the stronghold in your city? When I mean stronghold, do you see like where people are just being kind of, like their lives are being held in check? I'll use an example. This is just my take. Kids in Barrington, Illinois, it's not just okay to go to a Big Ten school. Most of those kids that I met in like high school, they felt this immense pressure to even go bigger than Big Ten. And I would sit with some of these kids, and I would listen to it. And I grew up in a culture of peer pressure. Like, what's my friend doing? What's they doing? Okay, maybe I should do what they're doing. I felt like constantly being pressured. This generation, they feel the pressure to be great within. It's causing profound levels of anxiety and sadness and depression. And I just would sit there, and it was like with these students, and I would just put my hands on their shoulders. I'm like, just be kind to yourself. Like you're 17 years old. Like you're already gone farther than I ever went as a 17-year-old. Just exhale. Just breathe. Receive what God has for you. Be kind to yourself. But the pressure was so high. That's a stronghold. Does that make sense? And how do you pray into that? How do you speak into that? How do you coach towards that and address that? Every city has those. In some cities, it's full-on escapism. I was in West Virginia preaching, and a whole city basically whose parents don't have jobs. And the opioid crisis is off. I mean, it is, there's not even a chart anymore. And you sit there, and you just have these kids who are like, there's nothing. What am I supposed to do? And literally, that's a stronghold. I have no vision for my life. And sitting with these 12-year-olds who's lost a 15-year-old brother, 17-year-old sister, just to this, is that my lot in life? And you sit there and go, no. What does vision look like? Who are you made to be? And trying to call that out. That's a stronghold. Every city has that. And I believe that as the church continues to retreat, we miss out on what good news can actually look like. And the beauty is when people have a real true understanding of what it means to be a Talmudim, a disciple of Jesus, and they understand what Jesus is doing in this world, and they have the strength to be strong and courageous, they will find themselves stepping into the places that feels, I know, so far over their skis, so scary, but you know what? They're not dependent on them. They're dependent on God. And you know what's so beautiful? Is this is how much Jesus trusts you. You read this passage, he literally just says, verse 19, and I will give you the keys of the kingdom. And whatever you bound in heaven will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed on earth. And this is Jewish saying, I'm entrusting you with the authority. I'm trusting you. And what gates you open up, what things you actually allow, there will be ground to be taken. Whatever thing you run away from, okay. But I'm trusting you. I'm trusting you as disciples. And then he just says, and the gates of hell, the gates of Hades will not overcome you. When you live this deeply with me, when you trust me, when you go with me, it's not going to overcome you. It's not going to overcome you. This might be heretical, but I'll say it anyway. This is probably not wise. But there is a band that I would listen to from time to time, but they had this line in their music, and they're not believers, but there was this one line that I could basically say was straight from this passage. And in the middle of the song, it just would say, it has to start somewhere, it has to start sometime, what better place than here, what better time than now, all hell can't stop us now. And I just remember thinking, man, like, it's as if Jesus had brought them to the brink of this, and looking at all of the brokenness of culture, and he's going, it has to start somewhere. It has to start sometime. What better place than here? What better time than now? All hell can't stop us now. Who's coming with me? And let's just be honest. For much of the church, Jesus is saying, all hell can't stop us now. Who's coming with me? And many of us are like, okay, just gonna go. Just get him, Jesus. You're awesome. And then we're like, I'm no longer a slave to fear. I am a child of God. You know, and that's not what we were made to be. We were made to love. We were made to roll up our sleeves and get messy. We were able to sit with people who were broken and hurting, struggling, addicts and people who are asking questions and people who have been like rejected and isolated. We were meant to be with them. And yet, for so many of us, and even myself included, there are times where I'm like, yeah, but what are people going to think? How are people going to perceive this? What are people going to say? And instead of living our life for an audience of one, we're continuing the stronghold. And the enemy's going, yes. And this is the real stuff for disciples. This is the real stuff for Talmudim. And when you play all of that stuff back, if you value the teachings of Jesus, you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, and you will love your neighbor. And you will be willing to extend, and you will be willing to trust, and you will be willing to pray against and pray for. And you will see strongholds begin to decimate because truth and grace and good news is an unstoppable force when Christ is at the center. What's the stronghold in your city? And where are you? Are you a slave to fear? Or is your family stepping on the necks of culture and changing the stories and welcoming people to the seat to experience the goodness of grace and truth and peace that's found in Christ alone. When I read Jesus' teachings, what keeps me up at night is not what I'm told not to do, it's what I'm invited to do. And that's what makes this message so beautiful. But it happens when you find yourself being strong and courageous, not in you, but in him. I told you I'd teach you some Hebrew, and I'll end with this. And this is like that first command. And so we'll end with this, okay? And so I'm going to invite you to stand up, all right? And what you're going to do is what I really want to do is have you like chant, all hell can't stop us now, but I'm not going to do that. Bring it back to Bible. So what they would do is they would lift up their pinky, okay? So little Austin Powers, but like lift up your pinky, okay? And the idea was that God had more power in his pinky. That like just God, like there was just this power in God, and then there was this just like person closeness. And they're both true. And sometimes we're like, you know, Jesus is so near, but we forget about the reverence and the power. And sometimes it's reverence and power, but we forget about the personal. This is just something that was so powerful. They would raise their pinky, and they would say from Deuteronomy chapter 6, 4, Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. So basically, hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. Okay, I'm not going to make you do the rest because that would be a lot of this. But okay, so what I want you to think about this, though, is that they would say this, and they would say it with passion. And I think that's also one of those things that is just disconnected from us standing on the cliff and entering into culture and creating beauty and good. So, man, you understand God's oneness, wholeness, beauty, and truth invading your city? Say it for your family. Say it for your city. Say it for your county. Say it for your state. Say it for the crises that are just, you feel like the enemy's taking ground and winning. And when you say this, like, just pray towards God. I want you to be the God in that city, the God in that school, the God in our family. I want you to be the one true holy God, all right? So, Shema Rael, let me hear you just say it real quick. Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Get the ha. Adonai, yeah, there you go. All right, little phlegm, all right? All right, so here we're going to say it one time with passion, okay? All right, so you can stretch it out and then raise a pinky. So, all right? Okay, raise the pinky. Shema Rael. Adonai Eloheinu. Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel. The Lord is God. The Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God. With all your heart. With all your soul. With all your mind. With all your strength. With all your muchness. And may God bless you. And may God give you the strength and the courage not to retreat. May we no longer be slaves to fear, but may we see our identity as the children of God and trust you wherever you are calling us, even if it means into places that are messy and scary and hard and make no sense. We trust that you are the God of clarity, you are the God of truth, and you are the God who can redeem and restore all things. We love you, God. It's Jamie Pray. Everyone said, amen. Thank you.